I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The head of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, is calling on world leaders to convert their pledges of support into cash to help victims of the tsunami. Countries like Germany, India, and Australia have sent helicopters and ships and hospitals. The U.S., meanwhile, has sent over 13,000 American military people in to help. 21 ships, 28 cargo planes, and 90 helicopters. It is one of the greatest commitments of American military power devoted to humanitarian aid in decades. This effort comes at a time when world opinion of the USA is at a low point, a time when people are more likely to talk about civilian deaths in Iraq and torture at the Abu Ghraib prison. So these scenes of humanitarian aid could make a difference, even according to Secretary of State Colin Powell.
I think it does give the Muslim world and the rest of the world an opportunity to see American generosity, American values in action. We care about the dignity of every individual and the worth of every individual and our need to respond to the needs of every individual of whatever faith. America is not an anti-Islam, anti-Muslim nation.
Today on The Connection, we're asking if the current images of the U.S. military delivering water and medicine will remind people of the positive side of American power. And will that make a difference in changing people's attitudes about America? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Andrew Bacevich is here with me in the Connection studio. He's a former soldier and a professor of international relations at Boston University. His latest book, due out this spring, is called The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. Andy, it's nice to have you back.
Oh, thanks very much.
And we also have with us Robin Wright. She is the Washington Post diplomatic correspondent joining us from a studio at the Washington Post. Hi, Robin.
Nice to be with you.
I want to start with you, if I can, Robin. How would you mark the importance of this moment for the image of the United States military?
Oh, it's terribly important. The question is, will the kind of pictures we all see on the front pages of our newspapers and on television around the clock of the American military role, will they play at all even in other parts of the Islamic world? This is an issue that dominates our or is the prism through which we see the tsunami today. Is it the image that dominates in other parts of the world that we're trying to change our own image?
And Robin, I've been gathering together clippings from Bahrain and from Jordan and from Malaysia, and that's kind of mixed. Some people are saying, here's a Jordanian columnist who says that America is, in fact, exploiting the suffering of people to improve its image, whereas someone in Bahrain, for example, is saying that the aid can take hold in the minds of Muslims and Arabs only if it's part of a wider move for America to balance its policies. So are you saying that it's a little early to tell at this point?
I think it's a little early, and I also think that a month from now, we're much more likely to be absorbed in Iraq once again and the images out of troubling images out of Iraq. One of the real problems with the American mindset, and it's true, it's reflected in the media as well, is that we have a pretty short attention span, and I'm not sure how long the tsunami is going to dominate the front pages and the pictures that we hope to get out to the rest of the world. It's much more likely that we'll be focused on the violence in Iraq, the election in Iraq, mm-hmm. and that's a place where the images are of American soldiers carrying arms and wearing flak jackets, not carrying relief goods to the poor in desolate Sumatra.
Andy Bacevich, you spent much of last year abroad and have told us earlier on the program that during that time you got an earful about Guantanamo Bay and the Geneva Conventions and Abu Ghraib. I'm wondering what difference you think these images will make as they are being broadcast around the world.
Well, I wouldn't think that they would have any significant impact. I mean, the complaint against the United States, especially in the last couple of years, is not that we're selfish. The complaint has to do with policies that we've pursued since 9/11, and whatever gestures we make toward the tsunami victims, and they're very important that we make those gestures, the complaints still remain the same. We're still occupying Iraq. We still basically have shrugged off things like Abu Ghraib. We're still complicit with corrupt regimes in places like Egypt and Saudi Arabia. So the images will go away. The fundamental complaint will remain the same, it seems to me.
Okay, but let's talk about Indonesia specifically, the world's most popular Muslim nation, a place where a lot of anti-Americanism is exchanged. And I mean, I see in the papers people saying boy, it's great to see the Stars and Stripes handing out medicine and food. But are you saying, as Robin's suggesting, that this may be actually a very brief moment and not something that'll have any staying power?
That's precisely what I think.
And what so let me go back to the comment that I quoted by the writer in Bahrain. Are you saying that it could be useful if it came with a change in policy?
Sure. But, I mean, it is a moral imperative that we act. And the more that the United States government and that we do as a people to respond to this horrific crisis, the better. It's a moral issue, not a political issue. But it seems to me if we're trying to then evaluate the political circumstances, the political dynamic, you have to go beyond humanitarian gestures to address the complaints of these people. And the problem there, of course, is that particularly, I think, in Washington and in official circles, there's a tendency to dismiss those complaints completely out of hand, to insist that, from our point of view, the Iraq circumstance is about liberation, it's about democracy, and to dismiss those critics who say, oh, no, this is actually motivated by other sorts of interests. I think we have to, if we're serious about changing our image in the Islamic world, we have to address the complaints about our past actions and current behavior.
Robin, it's a really interesting kind of which way do you look through the prism here? Because you can say, well, here are the sailors in their Seahawks appearing as a force for good. But Andy's quite right. When you listen to the administration, they talk about Marines in their Blackhawks in Iraq working as a force for good. Is it really going to get lost in the different perceptions of what's good?
Well, the real stakes here are the Bush Doctrine and the policy, as Andy pointed out. The Bush Doctrine is preemptive military action to confront any perceived threat, even if it hasn't challenged the United States yet, which has played out in Iraq, and also to press for democratic openings throughout the Islamic world, the last bloc of countries to hold out against the democratic tide. This is a critical year for the Bush Doctrine. It plays out in Iraq as well as in the Palestinian elections and efforts to revive the deadlocked peace process with Israel. So the tsunami is an important image, but it doesn't really play very much into the Bush Doctrine. And it is the Bush Doctrine that much of the Islamic world views the United States as. That's the prism, not the relief effort.
I wonder then, Robin, if the importance of the images that we're talking about may actually have greater weight here in this country as people consider how the military is seen. Less overseas, more here in America.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. As I said, I think that we see these pictures every day because the American media is interested in Colin Powell touring Indonesia and Sri Lanka and Thailand and seeing the Americans' helicopters landing in Banda Aceh in northern Indonesia. But I'm not sure those pictures are going to play a month from now when the U.S. military will probably still be deeply involved in this effort, that they'll play in the foreign press. I hope they do. My fear is that it'll be a fleeting and forgotten image.
Andy, what do you think?
Well, I'm a teacher, and I mean, I think it's as if I have a student in my course who cuts classes, never turns in assignments on time, and then the last day of the course comes in and gives me an apple. I mean, I'll appreciate that gesture. And the student may think that through that gesture, he or she has really somehow changed my assessment of what they've done. But the truth is, the gesture won't matter. I'm still going to look in my grade book and find that this is somebody who has, you know, failed to meet the requirements of the course. And I think that this, and from a political sense, again, not from a moral sense, from a political sense, the current gesture toward the tsunami victims is going to be about as significant in the long run.
Let me add one thing. The front page of the Washington Post today has two stories. One, the lead story is about a terror suspect, an Australian citizen who is Muslim, being forcibly taken by the United States to Egypt, where he alleges he was tortured for 6 months. The second story lower in the paper is about the hospitals overrun in Indonesia with tsunami victims and a picture of Colin Powell. It is the story of the terror suspect being tortured because the United States sent him to Egypt that is likely to get greater attention in much of the Arab world and elsewhere in the Islamic world today.
And that other story, Andy, about the FBI opening its new investigation into allegations of torture at Guantanamo, that's also in the paper today.
And Mark Danner's got a great op-ed in the New York Times, which really recounts this sort of growing wave of torture allegations, which have some substance to them. And that's the sort of thing that I agree is likely to resonate and have a longer-term effect in that part of the world than the pictures of American military people delivering rations.
And Robin, as you know well, the beginning of the Gonzales hearings in Washington today, which again will bring up those questions of the link between the Bush doctrine, torture policy, George Bush, and his lawyers.
Yes, and this plays to the kind of suspicions, unfortunately, that so many Muslims have about what U.S. policy is, what U.S. intentions are, what U.S. attitudes are about their part of the world.
Robin, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Robin Wright, Washington Post diplomatic correspondent. Andy Bacevich is staying with us for the balance of the hour. Nick Kristof is joining us when we come back after the break, and that's when we'd like to hear from you at the same time. What are you making of the images that, when you see them coming from the coastlines of the Indian Ocean, of American soldiers and sailors and Marines delivering medicine and food, rather than seeing the news from Iraq where it's all war and more war? Does it make a difference? Do you think it should or would make a difference in the rest of the world? 1-800-423-TALK to call. I'm Dick Gordon. This I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This hour, we're talking about those images of the American military involved in humanitarian aid around the coastlines of the Indian Ocean, somewhat different images than we've seen over the last couple of years, and asking whether or not it makes a difference here and abroad in the way people regard the goodness of the American soldier. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Andy Bacevich is here with me in the Connection studio. He's a professor of international relations at Boston University. And Nick Kristof is joining us on the phone from New York. He's a longtime Asian correspondent and bureau chief for the paper, and now works as a columnist there. Nick, it's nice to have you back.
I'm delighted to be on.
Can I ask you about the kind of mix of comments that I'm seeing in the day's newspaper? Here's Sam Brownback saying that, the world has seen America's resolve in dealing with terrorism. They also need to see our compassion. It's the goodness of America that leads to its greatness. And Representative Leach is also on the record here saying that our military has become an instrument of peace in the world when people see these scenes. What do you think?
I think that that's all true, but I mean, I think one shouldn't exaggerate the degree to which, a week or two of images of troops helping people in Indonesia, for example, are going to overcome, a lot of bitterness that has developed. If you look back in 1991, the U.S. military helped cyclone victims in Bangladesh. It was kind of one of the first times that the military had taken on that kind of purely humanitarian assistance. And it really did, I think, make a positive impression on people in Asia.
Were you there at the time, Nick? Do you recall?
I was there, yeah.
Because I think, Andy Bacevich, you may have been. Were you there? Or?
No, I wasn't there. I was just recalling during the break of that operation, which, as I recall, it was troops who were really beginning to deploy home from Desert Storm when this hurricane occurred. And there was a major effort made to relieve the suffering in Bangladesh. From my perspective, 14 years later, I don't think it really had any lasting impact in the political realm, even though it was certainly the right thing to do at the time.
Nick?
I think that that's largely true. I think it made a difference, but that it was a fairly modest difference, and it's much more remembered, close to home in places like Bangladesh rather than, say, in the Arab world.
And you wrote a piece which has got some attention calling or referring to America as a penny-pinching nation, Nick. And I'm just wondering, when you compare the tremendous amount of military muscle that is going into the distribution of aid to the dollar figure and the speed at which America got involved here, does one sort of cancel out the other?
I just think that impressions of America are formed by all kinds of things. You know, they're formed by aid, and certainly, you know, there's an awful lot of food that America gives, and everywhere you go in poor countries, you see these sacks of food, you know, marked USA, and those make, you know, some positive difference. I think American popular culture makes a difference. The openness with which America welcomes refugees, and not just refugees, but, you know, sports figures, all kinds of people from other countries, I think makes a real positive difference. On the other hand, things like Abu Ghraib make a terrible difference. And, things like the way we handle the Kyoto Accord, which, you know, none of these are, you can't put a price tag on them and they're hard to quantify, but it's just a huge array of issues. And a lot of it also, I think, has to do with kind of attitudes. I think that in the last few years, there's been a kind of a presumption of America as arrogant that has offended people, often in our kind of erstwhile allies. And that's, again, it's kind of hard to put a finger on, and it doesn't derive from any one policy. But I think that it has been important in the, you know, alienation of America to the rest of the world.
We're going to take our first call from Dubuque, Iowa. Bryce is joining us on the line. Bryce, tell me what you're thinking.
Well, my first thought is this, is that if this is just a PR campaign to me. First of all, I don't think the United States owes anybody an apology. I mean, first of all, when you give to a charity, you don't stand by and say, well, now I'm looking for my thank you card in the mail. You do it because you want to do it by the goodness of your heart, and you want to remain anonymous. If you don't want to remain anonymous, then it means you're looking for recognition or you're looking to gain something from your donation. So it turns into more of a thing of, well, what can I get from it? You know, if the United States is looking to just get positive PR from this, then they shouldn't give a dime because it's not a sincere gesture on our part. So to me, it's just like, you know, we first stepped up and said we're going to give, what, $36 million, and then Japan came in and said we're going to give $500 million, and it's turned into kind of a glorified Jerry Lewis telethon, and it really is starting to look like, okay, are we in for the PR? Are all these countries giving money because they really care about these people? Because what it's going to come into is this. Money is just the first step. That place is a mess. It's a wreck.
Okay,
the government is corrupt.
Bryce, just for the purposes of this conversation, separate the money race, because I think you're on to something there, but I want to try and focus in on the way that people are looking at the American military. You can't say that measure of involvement over there is done simply as a PR campaign. Maybe people are trying to exploit it, but there's got to be some goodness there somewhere.
Well, there is goodness there, and I don't think the United States owes anybody an apology for the American military. First of all, we've talked more about these allegations of torture than we have than the people who have been beheaded over there. I mean, and I don't mean to say it's an eye for an eye, but in essence it is. I mean, we're in a war here. You know, and people keep trying to sugarcoat it by calling it the war on terror. Mm. Or, you know, let's call it what it is. It's a war. And sometimes as cold as this sounds, is sometimes you have to take the gloves off. If you go back and you talk to World War One or World War Two and those veterans, they will tell you that sometimes drastic measures had to take place to get the job done. The bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima, was that a popular thing? If you were to ask people at the time, no.
Andy Bacevich, just to help me out with this, though, because what Bryce is saying is that, you know, you do one thing, you take your lumps for that, and you do something else, and it.
Well, I mean, I don't think that this is necessarily either a genuine humanitarian gesture or merely a cynical political ploy. I mean, in the realm of government action, everything has to have, necessarily has, a political aspect or dimension. Again, it is imperative that we do this thing because it is the right thing. It is not surprising that people inside government or observers of government wonder what will be the political impact of this humanitarian gesture. My point of view would simply be that let us not have exaggerated expectations. Our virtue seems much brighter in our own eyes than it does in the others. The political impact is likely to be modest.
And Nick, you've been on the road a fair amount lately, so you know about this anti-Americanism, whether or not it exists in Eastern Europe or Ukraine or places where you've been. But just sort of reflecting on what Bryce is saying, is it reasonable to say that the image of America remains marked by Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, and that it doesn't really matter what's going to happen in providing aid for the tsunami victims? People are, either by a sort of instinct towards anti-Americanism or by determination, going to stick with this kind of darker image.
Oh, I think it matters. And, you know, in terms of motivations, look, I mean, I give a donation myself, and I like to think it's out of the goodness of my heart. But, hey, if I can get a tax deduction for it, I take that tax deduction. And by the same measure, you know, the U.S., I think, genuinely wants to help people in trouble abroad, but it also genuinely has a problem with its image around the world. And if we can help people and at the same time do it in ways that will improve our image, I think that's great. Now, how much difference will it make? Look, it's not going to make a huge difference in the Arab world, where people are very much focused on the situation in Iraq, for example. But Indonesia, for example, is, you know, the world's largest Islamic country. It's a country that is at something of a turning point, where there has been a lot of hostility toward the U.S. at times. And I think that in Indonesia, that assistance is going to make a considerable difference, and that it will be remembered, you know, for years to come.
We're going to go to Salem, New Hampshire, for our next call. Sultan's joining us from there. Hi, Sultan.
Yeah, hi. I think it's very commendable that U.S. is helping so much there, and I think majority of the Americans are kind and good-hearted. But I think there's a confusion for the Muslims that on one hand we are so generous on natural disaster help, but on the other hand we. The things we under control, or we are screwing them up. You know, the majority of Muslims in this country live in fear. 42% of Americans think that our liberty should be restricted. Then comes, occupation in Palestine. Yesterday, 7 kids were bitten to pieces. We didn't say a word.
Let's go back just for a minute here, Sultan, to what you're saying about Muslims living here in the United States. Because at one level, you'd probably agree with me that the American military is not helping people in Indonesia because they are Muslim. They'd help they'd help them no matter what religion they are. So that's just sort of chance, right?
No, because a secular state is touting that particularly that we are doing because Indonesia is a largest Muslim country, and that's what the focus is, and everybody's touting that as, mm-hmm. as an example. But
so what you're saying is that the United States really perhaps ought not to be blowing its horn about that.
What I'm saying is that it's a confusion. I mean, which message should I take? Should I take a message when I see, you know, the destruction of Jenin by Israelis, or taking that, you know, lives every day killing and their occupied land, or my things will be restricted over here, propaganda by the right wing day and night, demonizing me, my religion. Mm-hmm. Which message would I take? You know, would I take that, the message that's coming from tremendous aid to Indonesia, or, you know, the message that's over here that under John Ashcraft and now under Gonzalez, I don't know what's going to come now into the next, you know, from fire.
Nick, what guidance would you give Sultan here in terms of what's the message?
Well, I mean, I think it's true that people base their decisions on all kinds of very, very complex factors. The Bush administration, when it came into office, tried to emphasize public diplomacy and, you know, went into kind of building the U.S. brand, as it put it, in the Muslim world and especially the Arab world, and produced television commercials and programs. And I think that was, you know, a very commendable effort to try to shape the American image abroad, but it was also just incredibly naive, because showing some brief clip on television in Cairo is not going to profoundly and immediately change views toward America. They're shaped by, you know, so many factors over so much time, and Iraq and the Middle East conflict is going to be central to that. In much of the Arab world, I think the thing that would most profoundly change attitudes toward the U.S. would be some indication that we are really pushing hard for a Middle East peace, even if we were to fail in that effort. So in that context, I think the military effort to help people in Indonesia, you know, it is going to help. It is one piece in a very, very large puzzle.
Bruce is joining us now from Pittsburgh, Massachusetts. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
What are you thinking?
Well, I was involved with Operation Provide Comfort, which probably nobody has ever heard of it.
Hey, I was there.
Oh, were you?
I think Andy might have been there, too. This was helping the Kurds in Northern Iraq.
I was there, too, briefly.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess you did hear of it then. All right. And I was in the military, you know, for a career, and that was probably the, you know, the most fulfilling part of that. I mean, yeah.
This was bringing the Kurds out of the mountains of southern Turkey and northern Iraq, providing the building the homes and the shelters for them.
Right. We were involved in. We were actually flying air cover for the transports that were dropping food pallets and such, and you know, I guess blankets and that sort of thing.
I know that made a big difference to the people in that part of the world. Bruce, what are you thinking in terms of the staying power of that in a larger sense?
I think it's very important, but unfortunately, I think, you know, the media, and it's not just the American media, I think it's the worldwide media, they have the, you know, if it bleeds, it leads mentality. And so if somebody's not dying or something, it's not going to stay on the front page for very long. And I think that's the problem that we're going to run into in Indonesia and in that area.
That people will end up saying, yeah, aid was provided, but people here died. And aid was provided, but these people didn't get it. That sort of thing?
I think it goes more to what you were saying before about it's going to pass out of people's consciousness, because the media is just not going to pursue the story. It's just going to end up being, you know, okay, well, everybody died, and then let's find somewhere else where people are dying. And, you know, what we're doing out there, except for the local people, it'll be very important for the local people, and I think it'll help us immeasurably in the local areas. But as far as worldwide opinion, I don't think it's really going to have a big effect.
Can I jump in there?
Yeah, go ahead.
I as a member of the media, I plead guilty. I mean, I think that that it's very true that we are not good at kind of following up, and that when a disaster happens, then we send everybody there and we report it. And then as time goes on, we kind of forget about it. And what we're even worse, I mean, in general, we tend to be good at covering things that happen on any one day. And the tsunami or an earthquake or any kind of a disaster is an example of that. We manage to do that really, I think, very effectively. But what we're not good at is covering things that happen every day. And, public health is the best example of that. I worked out that in Indonesia, every year, 181,000 children die before the age of five from, you know, diarrhea and this kind of thing. And that kind of ongoing crisis just dwarfs the suffering of the tsunami. But, that is going to continue after the reporters leave Indonesia, after the U.S. ships leave Indonesia. And that is not going to get coverage because it's happening every day. And I think that that is a real blind spot that we in the news media need to think about.
Nick, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today. It's nice to hear from you again.
I'm delighted.
Nick Kristof is a columnist joining us there on the phone from New York. He works as a columnist for the New York Times and has worked all over that part of the world, understands the way that people look at the United States. And that's where we'd like to hear from you. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're trying to kind of take a bit of a step back and a balanced look here at just exactly how people outside the United States and here in this country are looking at the involvement of American soldiers working as hard as they are right now to provide medicine and comfort and mobile hospitals to people in Sri Lanka and Indonesia and other parts of the Indian Ocean coastline. Give them the credit for that, but try and figure out whether or not it's going to make a difference when you balance that against what everybody else has been saying about the U.S. military, or what the media has been saying about the U.S. military when you talk about Guantanamo Bay and Iraq and Abu Ghraib. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. We're taking a look this hour at the world response, or the world's ideas of watching American soldiers in the Indian Ocean area, helping people, the victims, the families, the survivors of the tsunami, and whether or not that makes a difference in the way that people are regarding American power. I want to go for a perspective from outside the country, and we're joined by Narasimhan Ravi. He's editor of The Hindu, joining us on the line now from Chennai on India's east coast, very close to parts of the of that country that were hit hard by the tsunami. Chennai was, if I'm not mistaken, Narasimhan, also was Madras before, right?
That's right, Andy.
Tell me
nice to be on the show.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. Tell me if you would, whether or not the role of American soldiers and helicopters helping out is gathering a lot of attention from your perspective. I know that in India, it's primarily the Indian military that's working to provide assistance. So pull the lens back for us. Give us a sort of South Asian perspective, if you would.
Yes. In this scenario, India is not quite a recipient. In fact, it has provided its own military aid and support for the relief operations in Sri Lanka, for instance, and India sitting with the donors in the Jakarta conference. But it's still a very close observer of the American aid and American military aid operations going on in Indonesia. In a sense, if you look at the purely the monetary figures, the American aid has been slow in coming, and it's not quite of the magnitude that one would expect. But on the other hand, you have to add a tremendous military effort, the military resources that have been brought into the relief and rescue and rehabilitation operations in Indonesia. And I'm sure a great deal more of private charity will flow in for the tsunami victims. So it will all add up to a massive effort in the longer run. Still, I would think, if you look at this involvement, transforming world attitudes towards America, I would still think it is some kind of a band-aid therapy. It is necessary and useful, but not fundamentally healing. On the other hand, the goodwill it generates provides a tremendous opportunity to affect the fundamental transformation, I would think.
All right, so just a quick last question for you then, Narasimhan. What would that next step be that would, in fact, cement the change in people's minds?
You know, in India, for instance, you want to look for changes in policy, in posture. There are tremendous positives going on, working for the United States and India in terms of economic relations, in terms of interest in American culture, education, and so on. On the other hand, the negatives would be the India's relations with Pakistan, whether the U.S. would support Pakistan militarily and politically and diplomatically and strengthen its strategic relations. The war in Iraq, for instance, is a slight negative, but there isn't that kind of an outrage in India as one would find in, say, the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, it's a positive picture which holds the potential for strengthening American image.
Narasimhan, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Narasimhan Ravi is editor of The Hindu, joining us there on the line from Chennai. Andy Basevich, what Narasimhan reminds me of is that we could be guilty here of saying, so what does the rest of the world think? Because what people in India think is not in any way similar to what people in Pakistan or people in Indonesia or Malaysia, you know what
right.
I mean? That there's a danger of generalizing here, I suppose.
I suppose there is, but And I guess I'm about to be guilty of that. But, it does seem to me that we live in a time when the general perception of American power is that it expresses itself primarily in a military sense. And, I'm struck by the fact that when the nation responds to this catastrophe, we turn to the American military to be the agent or instrument of response. Why is that? Because as a matter of policy, for a long, long time, we have invested enormous resources in building up an enormous military capacity, which now, for a brief period of time, we can adapt for humanitarian purposes. But that's not what the military exists to do, even if it can be adapted at a moment like this. It seems to me that looking beyond the immediate circumstance, if we really wish to have this lead to something more dramatic in terms of the way we're perceived, we ought to consider investing resources in non-military instruments, building up the capacity to make a difference in these societies over the long haul. And the truth is, there's not a heck of a lot of support among the American people, regardless of political persuasions, to do that, because
just
it would be
very costly.
Just in practical
terms, do you mean sort of a rededication to the Peace Corps? Do you mean a higher percentage of money spent in foreign aid? What are you talking about as an alternative?
Sure. I mean, we are notorious. The United States is notorious for ranking on the very bottom of among the developed countries in per capita commitment to foreign aid. Why is that? I think it is because, apart from things like the Marshall Plan and the immediate aftermath of World War II, our impression is that it's money down a rat hole. Our impression is that we really don't know how to bring development to the undeveloped world, so let's not spend money there. Well, and I'm not trying to minimize the difficulty of this challenge, which I do believe is enormous. If indeed we want to change the view of the United States in the Islamic world, which is largely undeveloped, then perhaps we ought to re-engage with this problem and invest something like the amount of national effort in figuring out what makes development work, as we do in building aircraft carriers and precision-guided munitions.
Let's go to Fort Knox, Kentucky. Chris is joining us on the line there. Hi, Chris.
Doing,
I'm fine. Are you in the military, Chris?
I am.
Tell me whether or not you share the perspective that Andy was just outlining there.
In a manner of speak, I do. I kind of feel like right now the military is being used as kind of a do everything for whatever political party dominates, and we bear the brunt for everybody's, hey, we should do relief efforts, we should do wars. And we're being stretched, one, stretched thin, and then two, we get beat up constantly because we seem to be the political whipping boys for whatever political party is in power. As far as the relief efforts concerned, I think the U.S. needs to take its military out of that role. I don't think that's what we're intended for, and we need to expect the U.N. and other relief agencies and UNICEF, Red Cross, Red Crescent, to step up to the plate more and, I believe, fund more of it and show more of an effort instead of using our military for maybe political gain or world political footing.
Now, Chris, the UN or the Red Crescent is never going to have aircraft carriers and fleets of helicopters. So is there a certain sort of, okay, yes, we need to use military hardware in extreme situations like we're seeing right now?
I don't believe we should use them under the guise of the U.S. Maybe as a U.N. force, U.N. helicopters, a U.N. fleet, to a small extent. The aircraft carriers, there's, of course, the logistical problem there. I don't know if that can be handled militarily, but it would seem that the U.S. is the primary one putting forth those type of resources.
Andy Bacevich, you know that the Europeans have been scratching their heads over this, that the notions of what perhaps that continent could do in putting together these kinds of forces. The UN talks about it a lot. Within the U.S. military, there remains this sort of, no, we are who we are, and we're not going to be a part of those other organizations. Based just sort of reacting to what Chris is saying, is there a common ground here that does exist?
Well, I mean, if you're suggesting that the military military command structure will want to call the shots operationally and not be embedded in some sort of an international humanitarian relief structure, that's certainly true. And frankly, I think that reflects the views of both official Washington and of the, my Aunt Betty Lou in Illinois, that
right.
Our guys will work for our guys only. But it seems to, and I think that always the military, not just ours, but those of other countries, is going to be tapped for this immediate response. As you say, we're never going to have humanitarian relief fleets of helicopters that just sort of sit in the tarmac ready to go. But I would go back to the point that from a strategic perspective, if indeed we hope that from these efforts we can derive benefit beyond simply responding to the needs of people, that the issue was one of what happens after the last humanitarian relief helicopter mission is flown. To what degree is the United States seen as, and in fact does respond to the requirements of people in the Islamic world to come out of poverty, to come out of mm-hmm. the circumstances in which they live their lives. And that's going to require something other than military instruments.
And Chris, that's what you're saying. Don't use the soldiers to fix the rest of the world's problems. Find another way of doing it.
Exactly. And that's what I'm seeing, at least on my end, is the U.S. is too readily to say, yes, let's help fix the world. And I agree, fixing the world, fixing impoverished nations, helping people establish democracy in a free nation is a well and good idea. But we only have so many resources, and it seems like the only resource we seem to use is the military in every intervention situation that we have, and we're tapping the military thin. I mean, if you haven't realized, it's killing the soldiers, Marines, airmen, sailors, and it's putting them to the point of break where they're just like, look, guys, enough is enough. We can't do it all for the U.S. Quit using us as your political tools.
Chris, I appreciate your call. It's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Going to Schroon Lake, New York for our next call. Dirk's joining us from there. Hi, Dirk.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. I'm wondering what your perspective is on this.
Well, my perspective comes from about 10 years of working in 30-plus complex disasters around the world.
Wearing a uniform or working for humanitarian organizations?
Working for humanitarian organizations. My point here is that the term humanitarian is being misused. The military cannot be a humanitarian implementer. It's contradictory to the definition of humanitarian, because to be humanitarian, according to the Code of Ethics, you cannot be an instrument of any political entity or cause. Obviously not possible for the U.S. military or any military, no matter what they be. There's a huge debate in the humanitarian world about the use of military in complex disasters or natural disasters such as the tsunami. They obviously have a logistical role, but to be absent and to be seen as an agent of the U.S. who's interested in doing good, they're going to have to fall under the direction and supervision of bona fide humanitarian agencies, such as United Nations and others.
Which, Andy, you're saying there's no appetite for that, either from the American public, the American military, or American politicians.
I don't think there is. I mean, I guess I sort of resist that sort of purist definition of what constitutes a humanitarian action. I mean, it seems to me that If you're a young naval officer flying a helicopter in Indonesia today, regardless of what calculations are going on in the Pentagon or the State Department or wherever else, you are acting in a humanitarian capacity. I don't think that helicopter and that naval officer are the optimum instrument for a humanitarian action, but it seems to me that to say that because he was sent there with some political calculation in mind, which is the case, makes that, somewhat taints the action on his part, seems to me to be unfair.
Give me a kind of a historical look at this, though, because we started the program by talking about that great European affection for the American GI in the mid-40s. And since that time, and I think you were in Vietnam, there's Korea, and there was Vietnam, and there've been, Central America and the first Gulf War, and now what we're looking at is, has the world become too complicated a place to ever say that the military, can be a force for good? Is it always going to be a source of controversy when it's involved in doing what it's designed to do, and that is make war, kill people?
Well, I mean, it is chiefly it's chiefly designed to make war and kill people, and therefore these events, such as we see now, are always going to be the exception. I guess I don't know if the world has become too complex. We had a caller earlier who was saying, hey, look, we got to realize this is a war. Let's get serious. Let's recognize that nasty things happen. Well, yes, let's recognize that this is a war. And indeed, I would say that politically, this humanitarian operation does fit into this larger war. But this war is different from World War II and World War I. This war will not be won simply by crushing the adversary. There are too many people that we would have to crush, and the political cost that we would pay and the moral cost that we would incur are unacceptable. So we've got to win some hearts and minds, and in order to do that, it's going to take more than a military instrument.
And in a curious kind of a way, the conversation we're having about the good that the military can do in the disaster relief is similar to the conversation we've been having about Iraq, where you say, you know, even the Pentagon has been complaining. You never pay attention to the fact that we're rebuilding schools and painting gymnasiums and rebuilding water supplies. Again, not the sort of thing that the military, and every soldier will agree with this, is designed to do.
And not something, I mean, this is a point where the Vietnam comparison works. We had soldiers dig all kinds of wells and paint all kinds of schools and did all sorts of things in an effort to win hearts and minds in Vietnam, and it failed. It failed because the military itself was not adequate to that task. And there, as I would argue today, the United States failed to invest in the sort of instruments of action that could have made a difference.
Andy, it's great to have you back on the program. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Andy Bacevich is a professor of international relations at Boston University and author of a book coming out this spring called The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. Also on the program, Narasimhan Ravi, editor of The Hindu in Chennai, Nicholas Kristof, New York Times columnist, and Robin Wright, Washington Post diplomatic correspondent. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugars. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.